You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And Neil, we are again taping an episode in front of a live audience, digitally recorded, though, on Talking Machines. And if you want to be part of our live studio audience, big quotes, you can follow us on Twitter at TLKNGMCHNS or hit us up on thetalkingmachines@gmail.com. And our guest today for this interview on Talking Machines is Dr. Terrence Sanowski. Dr. Sanowski, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So we ask all of our guests the same question first. How did you get where you are? What's been your academic and industrial journey? You're also very involved in the NeurIPS conference. Tell us everything.
Well, a wise man once told me that careers are only made retrospectively. And I have no idea how I got here. There was no plan. It went through a sequence of stages, starting with graduate school at Princeton in theoretical physics. And from there, when I finished that, for reasons that have to do with the field of physics at the time, which was a little bit moribund, I went into neuroscience. So that was a postdoc. And then from there, that's when I met Jeffrey Hinton, and that changed my life because I met him at a small seminar here in San Diego in 1979. We hit it off, and from that, over the next few years, blossomed the Boltzmann machine and backprop, and the rest was history.
So Terry, who were you postdocing with? Were you postdocing in San Diego?
No. This was a postdoc at Harvard Medical School in the Department of Neurobiology with Stephen Kuffler, who was widely considered to be the founder of modern neurobiology, and it was an experimental postdoc. I actually recorded from neurons.
So 79, you're mentioning physics, it was a little bit moribund. I mean, in terms of connectionist modeling, that was also a very quiet period. There wasn't a lot going on. It was a sort of age of classical AI, right?
You're absolutely right. It was a neural network winter in the 70s, and it was primarily because of the failure of the perceptron.
Now, that's because you say failure of the perceptron. I read about that a lot. Do you think it really did fail, or was the Minsky paper a little, the Minsky book, sorry, the Papert and Minsky book sort of killed it, but was it a fair representation?
Well, it's interesting. I think that that's the myth, that book killed it. But I actually think that there are other things going on.
And Rosenblatt had died as well, which seems a pretty significant.
Yes. Well, he was a pioneer. But you have to understand that digital computers were really primitive back then. Even the most expensive, the biggest computers that you could buy don't have the power of your wristwatch today. Rosenblatt actually had to build an analog device, $1 million in today's dollars, to build a analog device that had potentiometers that were driven by motors, for the weights.
That was the learning, wasn't it? Potentiometers.
Yeah, because digital computers were good at logic, but they were terrible at doing floating point.
It's amazing. So he built that at Cornell, right?
That's right. Yeah, so funded by the ONR. In any case, by the time that we were getting started, computers was the VAX era. It was becoming possible to do simulations. They were small scale by today's standards, but it really meant we could explore in a way that Frank Rosenblatt couldn't.
So what you're saying around the perceptron, and so just for a bit of context, perceptron 61, is that right?
It was 59, I think was the book, but it was in that era of early 60s, yeah.
And so then there's this period where the digital computer actually wasn't powerful enough to do much, and then digital kind of overtook, and the ability, but these analog machines were just now impractical from a point of view of expense. So you're saying it's less the book and more of a shift to the digital machine that in those early days wasn't powerful enough to simulate the perceptron.
Yeah. So I have a feeling that history will show that AI was like the blind man looking under the lamppost for his keys. And someone came along and said, "Where did you lose your keys?" He said, "Well, somewhere else, but this is the only place where I can see."
I was reading a Donald Mackay quote recently at the beginning of his book about the eye, which is just a fascinating area. And I guess he spent a lot of his career on it. And he did work in the war on radar. And he was talking about the Ratio Club, which is these early cyberneticists, and the potential of the analog or the digital computer to be what represented the brain. And in his perspective was, he was sure it wasn't a digital computer, and he wasn't sure it was an analog computer either. And he thought it was kind of somewhere in between. But it feels like that in between is what you're saying, is that was the difficult bit to look, and perhaps a place that we're able to look now.
That's right. I think it's being driven, and this is true in all science, that what you can understand is really determined by the tools that you have for making measurements, for doing simulations. And it's really only this modern era that has given us enough tools both to make progress with understanding how the brain works and also with AI, because of the fact that we have a tremendous amount of power now. But, you know, just to go back to that early era, I think, you know, I once asked Alan Newell, you know, who was at Carnegie Mellon, and it was a time when Jeff Hinton was an assistant professor there, and I was at Johns Hopkins. And I, you know, he was at the first 56 meeting at Dartmouth, you know, where AI was born. And I said, you know, well, why was it that you didn't look at the brain and for inspiration? And he said, well, we did, but there wasn't very much known about the brain at the time to help us out. So we just had to make do on our own. And he's right. That was an era, you know, the 50s was kind of the beginning of what we now understand about the signals in the brain, action potentials, synaptic potentials. So, you know, in a sense, what he was saying was that we basically used the tools we had available at the time, which was basically computers. But what they were good at, what were they good at? They were good at logic, at rules, binary programming. So that, you know, that was, in a sense, they were forced to do that.
That's a really, I want to come back to 1979 in a moment, but there's an interesting context to that, because of course, Wiener initially was someone who spread across both these areas of Norbert Wiener, who was at MIT, founded cybernetics, spread across both these areas of the analog and digital. He did his PhD thesis on Ruslan Whitehead's book. But one thing I was reading about recently is there was a big falling out between Wiener and McCulloch and Pitts. And it's sort of interesting that Wiener wasn't there at the AI meeting in 56. And I sometimes wonder, was that more about personalities and wanting the sort of old guard to stay away? Because you always feel Wiener was someone who bridged these worlds.
You know, that's a fascinating story. I actually wrote a review of a book about Warren McCulloch, and that came up. They were friends. They actually had been friends. Yeah, it has something to do with their wives.
I think the lifestyle of McCulloch was not in line with. It's a sad story, but I guess the point you're making, which I think is, and I'd like us to take us back to 79 and the meeting with Jeff, is. And I think that that's true, despite this story between humans. The real factor that drove things then was the sudden availability of increasing cheap digital compute and no longer the need to do this work that Rosenblatt and Mackay and others had done of having to wire together a bunch of analog circuits that you couldn't reprogram to build a system.
Yeah, I think that was a dead end for the very reason you gave, which is that, you know, it's a special purpose device that isn't good for anything else. And really, if you're trying to explore, you need the flexibility of being able to try out many ideas. And that really is what digital simulation allows you to do.
I know. So you were there in 79. So by the time, what was the picture like in this era in 79? That seems like a critical period. You had the VAX, you had personal machines now in effect, or personal-ish machines.
So the interesting story, my first job was at Johns Hopkins University, and I was lucky enough to be awarded the Presidential Science Award, Young Investigator Award from, you know, the government. And along with that was a grant, basically, and it was also matching, so I had to get matching funds. But because of that, I was able to purchase Ridge computers, two Ridge computers, which had the power of VAX 780s, all to myself. And for a while, I had more power, computing power, than the entire computer science department.
You were the Google of 1979.
That's right. That's right. But it really, you needed it, because we were doing, you know, round-the-clock simulations. That was the era of NetTalk. which made a big splash. And it was...
Tell us about NetTalk, because I know what an inspiration it was to people who were an inspiration to me. So tell us more about NetTalk. What was NetTalk?
Well, it arose from a visit I made to Princeton and a graduate student, Charlie Rosenberg, who was working with George Miller, who's a very eminent cognitive scientist, language area. And so Charlie was really enthusiastic about neural networks, and he asked if he could come do a summer project. So I said, sure. And, you know, he was studying language, so he wanted to do a language network. And, you know, we cast around for a problem that, you know, a small network might be able to make some progress on.
What were the architectures available? What year is this, and what were the architectures available?
It was 85, I think summer of 85. And it was, you know, at that time, it was really interesting because when I visited Princeton, we were doing Boltzmann machines. But by the time that he showed up, Jeff had... with Dave Rummelhardt had just broken through with Backprop, which was an order of magnitude faster. So it meant we could simulate a much bigger network. Well, the problem we picked out was in phonology, which is how do you pronounce words? And I remember going to the library and there was a 250-page book filled with rules and exceptions to the rules and rules for the exceptions, you know, because English is a very irregular language and there are a lot of different influences.
And that notion was kind of driven by logic. That was the approach to language. Let's break language down into its which was the flavor of the decade, double decade.
Yeah, no, that was the era of Chomsky and syntax. And it was clear that, you know, the rule-based descriptions of something as irregular as English was really complex. And I actually remember Jeff visiting during that summer and telling us that we were crazy, that this is much too difficult a problem. It's a real world problem and that we should...
This is pronunciation. So yes. You were going to build a neural network to look at text and try and pronounce from
text.
That's
right. Text-to-speech. Text-to-speech is the problem.
Is it the world's first text-to-speech system?
No. In fact, there were systems that were out there. We bought DeckTalk, actually, which allowed us to actually hear the output of NetTalk, which made it come alive. To make a long story short, by the end of the summer, the biggest problem was finding a database. And so we ended up with a database. Carteret and Jones had done some transcription of real people talking. And on one side of the page was the transcription of the words. And on the other side was the transcription of the sounds of every letter in the word. And so we digitized that and we fed it in to a small network by today's standards, maybe 10, 20,000 weights and a few hundred units. We had a window of 7 letters, and we marched the words through the window one letter at a time, and then there were like 20, no, maybe 100 hidden units, and then one output unit, which was the sound of the middle letter. And it was phenomenal because when we started it, the first thing it had picked up on was the difference between vowels and consonants. That's the biggest regularity. But it sounded like this, ba 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 ga ga da 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 da, like a babbling baby, which was really very cute. But then about, you know, maybe a 3 or 4 hours later, you could begin hearing small words. And then by the end of the session, it was actually, you could understand it. And it was like, you know, really dramatic in a sense that it kind of spoke for itself. You didn't have to give numbers because, you know, you could listen for yourself. And this was a big...
This is 85, summer of 85, September.
Yeah, I think that was the summer of 80 because we think we had our paper in 86.
And so the PDP book came out the same year. So this is the book where backpropagation came out 86. But let's go back a little bit because you mentioned the Boltzmann machine and also, you know, what had happened from 79 up to... the launch of Backprop. I mean, so I think the launch of that book and NetTalk itself, that triggered the first neural network wave, which is how I got drawn into the community. But what about the neural network early spring from 79, which you were very much a part of with the Boltzmann machine? What was going on in those years?
There were a series of small workshops. And, you know, there were people who... Some of the pioneers, you know, let me describe one of them. It took place at a small resort outside of Pittsburgh, and Jeff organized it. I remember really clearly, I met Carver Mead for the first time, who's a famous computer scientist. You know, he's responsible, in our field for analog VLSI, neuromorphic engineering. But in computer science, he wrote the first silicon compiler, which allowed engineers, to write a program to build a chip, basically. But in any case, the drama, we were in the basement, with small little room with 20 people. Jeff was there, and I think, Jay McClelland, I think Dave Rummelhart, Feldman from Rochester, Dana Ballard. In any case, we were gradually making progress, but I remember up above us, there was a big convention. It was a supercomputer convention, Cray, Control Data. These were $100 million machines, and they had these big booths, unbelievable. And I remember Carver Mead laughing and saying that, they don't know it yet, but they're dinosaurs. They're going to go extinct. And I kind of chuckled. And
you were the furry mammals downstairs, yeah.
And right. Well, it wasn't, he elucidated. He said, the micros are going to eat their lunch, because he knew about scaling, about the fact that when you have a commodity product, that the thing is, and Moore's Law, by the way, he coined the term Moore's Law. It wasn't Moore, obviously. He came up the data, with Intel, but it was actually the actual Moore's Law, the name of it, came from Carver. And he knew that because he worked out the fundamental physics, device physics, and he understood that there's room at the bottom. Yeah. He was at Caltech.
Well, that's the Feynman quote, isn't it?
That's right. Feynman, and they taught a course together, by the way, which was kind of like a vision of what the world is going to be like in the 21st century, and they were right on.
There's plenty of room at the bottom.
That's it.
Yeah.
But
just think how upset they'd be when they see what we've done with it. Anyway,
but Carver was dead right about it, and he also said something very interesting, which is that digital computers are great for doing simulations, but you're never going to deliver into the field things that, with enough computing power, and so that's why the brain, for example, isn't a digital computer, because it would have to be the size of a small city.
This is why he went for neuromorphic engineering, yes. Right? So you're founder of that field where they use the analog region and it's a lot lower power.
That's right. It's all about power. If you want to deliver, say, power, computing power to a robot, right, you just can't have a supercomputer sitting there. You have to have something that is a very, very efficient, but massive, doing massive computations. And interestingly, we're just entering that era now. There's very special purpose machine learning chips that are coming online. TensorFlow and TPUs and a lot of these other chips. There's like at least 100 machine learning chip startups. But now I was the founder of a meeting, neuromorphic engineering workshop that has been held at Telluride for the last 25 years, and now that field is beginning to come into its own. And in fact, some of my recent research is showing how you could transfer a deep learning network, which uses continuous rate coded neurons, model neurons, to spiking neurons. And then from that, you can then load it into a chip.
So this, just for context, neuromorphic engineering, which is so cool, they sort of have they implement little analog models of the neuron on the processor. But those are spiking models. So they're not the sort of cartoon model that we use in artificial neural networks. They actually spike, don't they? And you're saying that you can take the trained cartoon neural network model from a sort of machine like in TensorFlow or whatever else and map that to a neuromorphic implementation, which is a spiking neuron, the sort of noise they make. Sorry, that's my impression of a neuron. Probably not a very good impression.
Yes, we're at the cusp. Where we've at least demonstrated proof of concept, and now it's Intel is building Loihi, which is a big spiking chip. By the way, it's interesting. You were talking earlier about, is the brain digital or analog, and it is a hybrid because it uses membrane potentials to do all of the low power analog computing, but then in order to communicate, it uses spiking, which is an all or none digital like event.
But then the rate codes have some analog nature to that as well. It's a sort of, that's even hybrid, right?
Well, it's interesting. It is. If you talk to systems neuroscientists, of course, that's the signal that they record are the spikes averaged over 100 milliseconds, you know, in bind. We know there's a rate code there, but the spikes are actually asynchronous, which means that you can carry additional information in the timing of the spike. And we're just beginning to appreciate how that's done in large-scale networks.
You've covered, I mean, I just think we could have like an entire separate podcast on Talking Terry, because you have seen so many things. But the context of before, so the Cray era workshop.
Can I interrupt you for a moment?
Sure.
You mentioned Don MacKay.
Yeah. Well, Don MacKay, just context-wise, well, you may be about to say this. You go ahead. Go ahead, Terry.
No, this is a wonderful story. I mean, I almost forgot this, but you're bringing it up reminded me. So in the middle of NetTalk, I got a little package from David MacKay, his son. And he was an undergraduate at Cambridge at the time. And he implemented NetTalk, you know, in local computing. And he sent me his results, and it was in a small handwriting on a 3x4-inch pad. And I still have this. I mean, this is, you know, Dave MacKay, who became a giant in the field, right? Information theory, and, you know, died tragically. But, you know, he I think that we inspired some of the brightest people on the planet to sort of jump in, including you.
I think David and me can't be mentioned in the same paragraph. David was my inspiration, and Ryan's my predecessor as a co-host. But I think what you're sort of, what I love about these stories is I know how much NetTalk was an inspiration for him. I mean, his father, as you said, Don MacKay, do you know, I dug out a little story. Donald MacKay was invited to the Dartmouth workshop in 56, but didn't go. Now, I think the reason he didn't go was because Robert MacKay, David's older brother, was born that summer, I'm guessing. And I often think about that, because Donald MacKay was another person who, as you say, thought about the brain as this hybrid system. Shannon, I think, was there. And Shannon would have been someone, I think, who could have definitely gone the logical way. But you sort of sometimes wonder what would have been. I think you're probably right, but it's a little, you know, that it's actually just about the hardware. It's just a little game I play with my head. I wonder what would happen if Don MacKay was there as well.
You know, in addition to that workshop, there was another series of meetings that were held at the same time, the Hosea Macy conferences. And the similar cast of characters, you know, Wiener and I think Shannon was there, but also included people like Margaret Mead, anthropologist, Ralph Gerard, and when I was a graduate student in the long summers in Princeton, which was very hot and muggy, I was reading these conferences, and it was the books were coming out, which was a transcription of the exact discussion that they were having, not just, you know, chapters, but discussion. And it was fascinating to hear how each one of them came to this field. And Warren McCulloch was a ringleader who kind of organized it. One of the big disappointments of my life when I came to the end of these conferences, because I was expecting, well, what's going to happen next? And they were in the 50s and extending into the 60s, and it just disappeared. It was like, you know, poof, and everybody went their own way.
But I really am, I'm super interested in your interpretation, which I think is a really sensible one, that basically, you know, the digital computer came into existence and there was a whole load of stuff you could suddenly do on this machine that may not be the brain, but it was pretty cool anyway. And there's this sort of era of conversation, which when you go back and look at it, I think we're just getting back to today in terms of, I mean, if you look at the success of ideas that came from cybernetics, like the theory of automatic control, but you don't see their history in cybernetics. I feel that there's this tenuous thread, which we've been exploring, between the machine learning community, what was the connectionist, the neural network community, and cybernetics. I think it's a thread that goes through time. And one of the things I think is fascinating about your career is you were someone who came in and were inspired to grab onto that thread. As you say, because you felt physics was a little bit moribund, but not half as moribund as connectionist neural networks were at the time.
I see. Well, you know, youth is very ambitious and risk-taking. You know, that was the era Jeff and I were absolutely convinced, you know, that this is the future. And even though we were the furry little mammals, that, you know, we would inherit the Earth. You know, how naive we were.
Well, and how much work does it take? And actually, something, there's so many things I could ask you about. But I want to go and ask you about something that you've not just been influential on the technical side, inspiring people like David Mackay to come into the field. I want to ask you, first of all, about Ed Posner. Tell us a little bit about how Ed Posner came into this scene and what your relationship was with him, because I think many people won't have heard of him. And he's a critical character in this story, right?
Yes. Well, as you know, Ed Posner was the founder of the Neural Information Processing Systems Conference and Foundation, which I inherited from him after he died from a tragic bicycle accident that got hit by a truck. But he was a very wonderful character. He had great sense of humor, but he was also very practical. He was an engineer. He was at JPL. He had a faculty position at Caltech in electrical engineering. And what he recognized in the early days of neural networks, this is when it started becoming popular again. That was in the 80s. We were having small meetings at Snowbird, but it became clear that more people wanted to come. We didn't have enough room. So he said, we got to have a meeting where it's not by invitation, but, you know, anybody can register to come.
So the Snowbird meetings, just because they're the source there, people may not know the full history. Tell us, the Snowbird meetings, that's in Snowbird, is in Colorado.
In Utah. Was a ski resort, actually.
It's a ski resort, and there were small workshops of the type that you were just commenting with the Cray people above, where you just bring a few people together on an invitational basis.
Yeah, that's right. It was basically a logical extension, but, you know, it had gotten up to several hundred people at that point, and we overran the resort. But what he did was arrange for a bigger venue in Denver. It was a Denver Tech Center. And what he was really good at, okay, so when you're starting a meeting like that, there's a lot of upfront expenses. You have to, somebody has to sign for the contract, which you can, you know, you are liable for. And he managed to get the IEEE Information Theory Society to front us. In other words, for the first couple of meetings, they were the sponsors. And that was great because, you know, we were, that way we felt that we were safe. But it started taking off, and at that point the International Neural Network Society was founded, and the IEEE Neural Networks, and so it was a period of great growth of you know, going from a small.
But there's a critical decision there, because this is fascinating to me, because I don't think people truly understand this, but one of the strengths of our community is that we had our own foundation that ran our own conference, which gave us independence of decision making. That allowed us to decide that we didn't want large conference fees, or we wanted to publish in open ways. We were never beholden to any of the professional institutions which had these stipulations about how their conferences should be run, where things should be published. And what you just said is really important, because you're saying for the first 2 years, it was IEEE information theory. So why then form the foundation? The easy decision would have been to say, hey, IEEE, you know, why don't you just assimilate us? And then the whole history of machine learning could have been very different. So there's a critical decision to say, actually, we're going to form our own foundation, and it's going to be a light touch thing that just supports the conference.
You know, I wish that Ed was still alive so I can ask him that question. You know, I don't really know what his insight was. You're right. That was a critical moment. And by the way, you know, you're absolutely right about IEEE, although it is the largest professional society. I just recently looked it up. It's like half a million people around the world. It's unbelievable. But, you know, those early days of the, was formerly called NIPS, were magical, because we were a community of, I think the first meeting were 600 people, but we were a relatively small community for many, many years. It grew linearly, very slowly, over decades. And it was some of the best times of my life, was going to those meetings, because of the fact there was so much energy. You know, the poster sessions would go to 2 a.m. We formed lifelong bonds, because these were people.
That, by the way, I think are critical in these moments of turmoil. Like, I keep seeing those bonds being important for dealing with moments of stress associated with the super exponential at some point growth of the community. Stress associated with the pandemic, I mean, I think we're rather avoiding that now, but one of the things that has been so special to me is, as I advise on policy in the UK, I can reach out to a network of people I met at those meetings who have a diversity of interests, who we have a bond of trust with that survives whatever the current politics are, whatever the current flavor of the month is, to mean we can communicate about what actions are sensible. Sorry, I interrupted you, but I just think that can never be underestimated, those bonds you're talking about.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that they're like with Jeff, you know, these are lifelong. So, you know, the amazing thing about this community was that the people came from, an amazing variety of backgrounds. I mean, I was coming from physics and neuroscience, and Jeff was coming from computer science and psychology. And there were people from, you know, computer vision and speech recognition, statistics. But these weren't the mainline people. These were all people who were dealing with intractable problems, you know, and all believed that learning would be a key to being able to unlock it. It was really being driven by this concept of learning, which it was in AI at the time was hardly represented. It was, you know, considered write a computer program.
Well, I think the AI community significantly looked down upon the connectionist community. I think there was a lot of snobbery around it at once.
Oh yeah, they didn't really take us very seriously. I remember Jeff had a summer school at Carnegie Mellon, and so we got a lot of really great students. By the way, the funny thing at that first meeting, we have a picture, and if you look at the picture, it's just filled with, you know, people who are now famous, like Michael Jordan.
Right? Yeah, no, the connection is summer school.
Right. Yeah. Out of MIT.
Richard Durbin, who is yes, famous not in machine learning.
He was there. Richard Durbin, I remember. Yeah, I remember. Yeah. And there was, out of MIT came a spoof where they were going to have a connectionist cooking school. at MIT,
because they were the AI, the home of AI.
Right, they were they were just making fun of us. But you know, at the end of the first summer school, the students put on a skit, and here's what they did: they simulated NetTalk. So you know, they lined up in rows, you know, hidden units, input hidden units, and the output unit. And what they did was they simulated putting my last name through the window of students in the front row. And so there, everything was going well. S, E, when it got to J, it made a mistake. Bah. And that was when the learning took place and people would bash each other's head all the way back to the front row.
Did it learn faster or slower than the, I suppose it was in the machines
at
the time.
You know, this actually, it was the spirit of the time, which was that, you know, we were doing things that we thought would have an impact, but was still, there were still toy examples that were, and Jeff was a master at this. He could put together a network that could do amazing things, but it was all, you know, with a very small number of inputs. And
I never understood this until I think it's kind of widely known, but I was trying to just understand the relationship. His great grandfather was the son of which Hinton is it? I used to be able to say
it was Boole.
It was Boole and
Hillary.
No, Boole's wife, Everest. So George Hinton's is related to the person who surveyed Mount Everest is
That's
the
right.
original name, but everyone pronounces
That's
it
right.
Everest. Charles Howard Hinton, it's come to me. That's how the neurons work. Charles Howard Hinton married George Boole's daughter, who was a descendant of Sir George Everest. And Charles Howard Hinton was the inspiration very probably for H.G. Wells's Time Traveler, because he used to talk about the fourth dimension. He was an early science fiction writer who wrote these stories about what it would mean to move in the fourth dimension. And I can't read H.G. Wells' Time Traveler without thinking of Charles Howard Hinton as the main part now. But he married Boole. So this guy who could think in high dimensions married the child of the person who developed Boolean algebra, and after a couple of generations popped out the only person in the world that has the intuition you're just talking about, because you had we need to start breeding them somehow, because he's unique in that way. Absolutely
unique.
The
English are very good at this, as you know.
Well, his family was kind of, Charles Howard moved to the US because there's a story yes. there. He kind of had to leave because he also married someone else after marrying
right.
at the same time. Right. But yes, let's move on.
I have two stories. One, I have a recent paper that came out in PNAS, which came out of a National Academy meeting, but it features Charles Howard. For the reason you gave, that he could imagine the fourth dimension.
He invented the word tesseract, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And the whole theme in this little essay is that what we've entered in is a new era of very high-dimensional spaces, you know, in terms of parameter spaces, and that I use Flatland as the intro. In other words, this is a book by Abbott in which people lived in two dimensions. Your status in society had to do with the number of sides. So if you're a triangle, you're like a soldier. If you're a square, you're a gentleman. And if you're a sphere, you're the king. Victorian. It was a Victorian spoof. The square imagines a third dimension, which is, you know, a sphere. And of course, he went around talking to people and they thought he was crazy. So they put him in a loony bin. But you know, here we are. I mean, if you're going back to our early days at the NeurIPS meeting, we were imagining, you know, we had created the future because we imagined, you know, if you had enough data and if you had enough parameters, what could you do with them? And that was, you know, high dimensional, the foundation of high dimensional networks and high dimensional. And now the statisticians are piling in because they're realizing that.
Well, and I was at an amazing meeting with Yosha and Jan, organized by Denny Terrien recently, which was focusing on the theory of deep neural networks. And I think that the new theories around the double dip phenomenon, you know, and how learning dynamics might help with regularization are just fascinating. It was a fascinating meeting because I would say 60% was stuff we were looking at the last time neural networks were in, sort of 15 years ago, but with different people and new ideas, very exciting. But then a good 30% was like, oh, wow, we never thought that that was the answer. I noticed one of the questions is a really great question about how do we get that feel to the early community? And as you say, it's such an exciting time where you're interconnecting the people. But one of the advantages of this enormous community now is you've got such a large number of people and such clever people coming in and looking at these specific questions.
Absolutely. It's really astonishing. And, you know, this meeting I was at was actually organized by mathematicians, including Fields medalists. You know, in other words, there are paradoxes that don't make any sense from traditional statistics of, you know, sample complexity or optimization. You know, non-convex optimization shouldn't work, right? We were told this. And, you know, well, we simulated it.
According to the theory, just like the bumblebee doesn't
right.
fly,
exactly.
right?
Exactly. By the way, to finish the discussion about George Boole, so I have his book, which is
Laws of Thought. Well, that's the short title, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And what was surprising, you know, everybody thinks this is the kind of the beginning of digital computing, the Boolean algebra. But if you look at the book, half of it is about probability theory. In other words, he recognized that thought was not just logic. Thought really involves coming up with statistical analysis of data and coming up with estimates.
I think the innovation in that book is more about the fact that he works out that you can re-represent logical propositions symbolically, right? So he comes up with an algebra. And I think that that's part of this movement in 19th century maths, where they start developing new algebras, right, around these sort of things. And that as well, you're totally right, the probability is key. But this innovation that you can move from logic to symbols, and then you can move from symbols to electronic components is at the heart of this stuff.
No, that was, it was clearly a precursor to, you know, a digital computer. No doubt about that, but he was also the precursor to modern machine learning, if you think about it.
Well, I think it's endlessly fascinating how often these ideas are there in the old books, but they just did not have the tools. And goes back to the point you were making that they had the digital computer. So you look under the place where the lamp is pointing, even if you know that can't be it. People had thoughts very close to what we do today, but they didn't have TPUs on cloud computer to test those thoughts out.
Yeah, no, they made the best out of what they had. There's another interesting, I think, sociological reason why it was difficult to make progress that way. And that is, you write a big computer program to solve some problem like, you know, Bloch's World, you know, 100,000 lines. And now how do you build on that? The next graduate student comes along and, you know, it's spaghetti code. How do you make progress?
So Bloch's World, just for context, is this AI problem where you had to move in two dimensions a series of blocks from one place to another, and you had to get the order right. So they were building planning algorithms, I suppose.
Yeah, planning. And, you know, they had a robot arm that would pick things up.
Not a real one, a simulated one, right?
No, actually. Oh, you did. Okay, yeah. You know, this is an AI lab. The I forgot the name of the graduate student. He went on to, in any case, the point is it's very difficult to make progress by writing a computer program on top of another computer program that has different formats and different, making different assumptions about, you know, what the signals are. You need to have some unified way.
Yes and no. With programming, they formalized it with object-oriented programming. But I think the point you're really driving at is that research didn't lead to a fundamental unit of intelligence, which I'm not saying we've got today. But what we do have is this sort of notion of a layer and the way that layers can be constructed in interesting ways and different types of layers. They can be composed together, which somehow gives you quite a fundamental way of building very creative algorithms.
Yeah, and in fact, we're at this point now where we have these deep learning nets that are have very specific capabilities in vision and speech and language. But what you really need to do is to integrate them all together, which is what the brain does, globally integrate them. And because of the fact that they're all using the same representation, types of representation, eventually that will happen because you're integrating information using learning algorithms as the glue. And so that's why we are able to build layer upon layer to be able to eventually solve the most difficult problems, which we're just beginning to approach, which is, you know, general intelligence.
Before we go to the questions, because we're probably overrunning, but just one last thing that you told me, which totally stuck with me when I think you were kind enough to allow me to share your taxi on the end of a Europe's conference once. The layered structure that we just spoke about, I think the point we were talking about is in many animals, including birds, the visual system isn't like that. So if we look at the neurobiology, our visual system has elements of that, but there are other animals where their visual system doesn't even use that. And I just kind of found that mind-blowing because I just felt, so this thing we've got, this thing we're doing that's doing all this stuff is not actually the way things are normally done in the brain. And I just wanted to see if you could say something briefly about that, because it was such a revelation to me. I just assumed, well, all visual systems are like that, at least.
Well, it is a fascinating story. So it turns out that deep learning is a model for the cerebral cortex, which is a mammalian invention. A couple hundred million years ago, you know, the furry mammals had this six-layer neocortex. But before that, if you go back to birds and frogs, reptiles, they don't have this neocortex. They have something called archicortex, you know, old cortex. And it turns out that in these species today, still, the highest level of visual processing is not the archicortex. It's the I'll call the optic tectum, which is homologous, similar to what we call the superior colliculus in the mammals. But it has the same layered structure. So it turned out that these earlier species did have a visual system with layers, but it wasn't the kind that we have in our cortex. It was nuclei that were connected together, which were accomplishing roughly the same thing that the mammalian neocortex, which has sort of taken over the high-level vision from the superior colliculus, which is still used, by the way, to guide eye movements. So it's nature doesn't throw things away, it just repurposes them.
Well, and that actually rather nicely ties us back to Donald Mackay, who was very, very interested and really interesting work by Kevin O'Regan, we've spoken about on the show before, and eye movements and how fundamental they are. But I think we should go to some questions. And Catherine, I know there's been some coming few with some that caught your eye.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that the first question, Terry, that I'd like to put to you from this raft of amazing questions that we have is specifically about your research. Andrew asks, research on the brain is notorious for suffering from noisy or inaccurate sensors. How do you advance ML and neurobiology with so much difficulty in gathering clean data?
So there's been a revolution in the last 5 years. The Brain Initiative, Obama's Brain Initiative, has produced incredible advances in recording devices. So we used to record from one neuron at a time. Now we can record from tens of thousands of neurons at the same time. And with very high fidelity simultaneously from many brain areas at the same time. Here's the irony. The irony is that, you know, how do you analyze data like that? You can't do it by hand. You have to use some analytic approach. And machine learning turns out to be the way that neuroscientists now are being able to see things in the data that they're recording. And, you know, it's ironic that we were, you know, we were starting out, we were inspired by the brain back in the 1980s. But the tools that we developed basically are now the ones that are needed to make progress with understanding the brain. And by the way, you know, there are people like Surya Ganguly out there right now who are just tearing up the playbook in neuroscience. I mean, he's basically been able to, using recurrent network models, be able to explain so many of the observations that neuroscientists are making, like grid cells in entorhinal cortex, which is amazing that, you know, this is the Nobel Prize was given for this a few years ago. And now I think we have a fundamental understanding of how it emerges, you know, through development and what it's used for navigation.
Fantastic. I think we've got time for one more because Terry, I want to respect your schedule and all those back-to-back Zoom calls that I know you've got coming up. So Francois asks, how much do you think that we need a change in the algorithms versus just more data and more compute? Do you think that current neural networks are good enough?
Okay. I'll tell you where we are right now. We are in the early days, equivalent in the 250 years ago at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution with the first steam engine. Right. And it took 100 years for that to be perfected and the theory of thermodynamics. Like we were talking about the mathematicians, they're just creating the theories that are going to create the next generation of algorithms. I actually think that, you know, we talked before about looking under the lamppost. Well, now we have light that has stretched out over a much bigger area of very high, you know, what can you do when you have a billion small compute devices? What kind of algorithms run efficiently on such a computer, right? That's a different architecture and different algorithms. And we're just starting to think there's probably a whole universe of algorithms out there that we can't even imagine yet. So I think, you know, it'll take, I hope not 100 years, but I think we're on our way.
So Janowski's law is the law of the lamppost becoming brighter as machine learning algorithms get better, and the machine learning algorithms getting better as the lamppost gets brighter. And that cyclic effect is kind of what you're saying will drive innovation.
Excellent. Dr. Sinowski, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate having you on Talking
Machines. Oh, you're very welcome. It was really a lot of fun. Thanks.
Excellent.
Thank you.
That is it for this episode of Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
Tune in next episode.